I think early in the campaign they're not very good because I framed the really good ones.
Yeah, little Paul Phillips.
Yeah.
Big pictures of Vic in the back.
Yeah, Vic and Dolores.
Vic and Dolores, that's great.
Yeah.
You know, I've seen several of her with a lei on. Yeah. Is there some affinity there?
I don't know what it was. She would wear them for a celebratory occasion.
Huh.
In fact, I have some pictures from one of the governor's conferences.
Yeah.
That she's wearing one.
Yeah, so something to ask her kids.
Paul and then Vic and...
Oh, his T-shirt.
Yeah.
That's great.
And Greg Walden looking very young.
Yes.
He was 21 years old at the time.
Yeah. Yeah.
When I hired him. But there's some wonderful pictures. I mean, just nice. I mean, they don't say anything. Unfortunately, they have no action to them. But
I drive the best. Yeah. I interviewed Bob Atiyah, who drove during the primary.
Oh, yeah.
And he loved it. He learned a lot. But, boy, he was so happy to give it over to Paul.
Oh, and he was...
The politics just drove him nuts eventually.
Well, what happened, though, with him that he probably didn't mention is that... He was just a slob at that age.
Oh, yeah?
And he would show up in work boots and have his shirt unbuttoned almost to his waist and just come lounging in. And and he was just, he drove Dolores nuts.
Yeah.
Finally, they went to Hood River for an event one night. He forgot to fill up with gas.
Yeah.
They ran out of gas on the highway, Columbia River Highway, in a rainstorm. Dolores was pissed. She made sure that Vic decided he needed a different driver.
Yeah, well, Bob had already come to that conclusion.
Yeah, I guess. Well, Dolores is difficult.
Yeah, you know, I picked that up from various and sundry people.
This is a governor's, Republican governor's meeting in Chicago. Vic was chair of RGA, and there's a bunch of pictures of him and Dolores and him alone. In here that are kind of nice, but that's I don't know if you'd want any or not. They're probably not. They're just standing and talking to the group and the...
Yeah. No, anything you want to get to the archives is good.
Well,
and these have the advantage. They actually have names under them.
Oh, yeah, and they have all the governors who were there in 1983.
Yeah.
Most people don't remember Olson, who was from North Dakota. Janklow.
Yeah.
I saw the angle.
Here's Sununu.
Yeah,
the second era American governor.
Yeah. He was. He was so nice when he was governor. And when he was working with us and we were doing the Governors Association, he was so nice. And then people got this idea that he was a nasty person when he helped in the White House. He wasn't.
But also in the White House, you're in that role. You're much more of a gatekeeper.
Yeah.
Big Jim.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He was wonderful. We had the best time. When he was the one who hired me to run the Governors Association.
Oh, okay.
The Republican governor.
Yeah.
And so we had a funny relationship. He interviewed me in spring.
Excuse me.
And he was really mad at the RNC at the time, and I was running. Oh, I was head of field operations at the RNC, and but I wanted to get out of that mess, and he had me wait in his outer office for like 2 hours.
Oh,
I was so mad by the time I got in, and I finally walked in there, and he said, "What's going on at the RNC?" And I said, "I don't know, but I know that you're rude." I just couldn't help myself. You made me wait for 2 hours, and you're going to yell at me now? We had a great time.
Yeah.
He used to come and sit in my office. He'd throw himself down in my office on the couch, and he'd have two or three state troopers waiting outside.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd say, "You got anything to drink?"
Mm-hmm.
He liked bourbon. He was great. Vic was not that interesting because he was a little better behaved.
Yeah.
But, see, they're mostly just...
Oh, Dick Thornburg, yeah.
Oh, yeah. He was chairman of RGA the year after Vic.
Alexander.
Yeah. I learned not to like Dick Thornburg. He's sneaky. And there's Terry Branstad, who is governor again. He was so young then.
His fifth time.
Isn't that amazing?
Just incredible.
The first time, he was young.
Yeah.
That was,
well, it's like Jerry Brown. I mean, Jerry Brown had none of the issues that Kitzhaber had. You know, Kitzhaber is like, you know, what? Why are you running again? Whereas Jerry Brown, I mean, it had been a generation and a half. And so in California, those dynamics didn't exist.
In a generation and a half, he'd improved a lot.
He changed very much.
Yes.
I was talking to Vic actually last June, last time I talked to him. And he grudgingly admitted that he might actually agree with Jerry Brown on some things now.
Yeah, it's hard now. But Jerry Brown was so rude, too.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
There was a party. Governor DuPont had a party when I was... I guess it was the first year I was at running RGA, and it was across the street from the headquarters at a townhouse, and he invited a lot of the governors, most of them I think made it, and it was to celebrate the terms that were just ending for, God, who was it, Iowa and Michigan, what's his name, Milliken. Anyway, it was there. Somebody else, three of them, who had been forever. And he had this party, and Jerry Brown was there. And I was standing there by the fireplace, just looking at something. Jerry Brown comes walking over to me and says, "Who are you?" And I told him my name. He said, "What are you doing here?" I mean, what? He was so awful. God, he was awful.
I actually had that problem with Earl Blumenauer's Washington, D.C. office this morning.
Really?
Because Earl's the last person who actually served in the legislature with Vic who's still serving in office. So there's some great stuff there. But you know, getting together with the congressman is kind of nuts.
And so I
called this morning. Someone had called yesterday. So I called. And probably a rude young intern. Who are you? Are you a constituent? It's I'm returning a call. You just put me through to Nicole and do it now.
Yeah, and some of them get
just like
big heads.
Get a grip.
These kids, they're all young and they get.
Get a grip.
Anyway, so there's some pictures in here. You know, if you were interested in this, you could probably.
I would love that.
I have some pictures. Well, who cares about pictures of me? I would say I have some of my really good pictures. like the one with Governor Thompson that I think is the best. But never mind.
That's great. On these, before I go, let's put names on the back.
Oh, yeah. Now, these are...
As many as we can remember.
Well, this is just me.
Okay.
You don't
need and who?
Oh, a woman who was a neighbor of mine.
Okay, well, there you go.
This was at the party. And I can't even see who this is. It's so fuzzy. You would recognize Dolores, of course, and Vic. And, oh, shoot. With the Paul Phillips t-shirt. I can't remember his name. Yeah, I can't remember her name. She was one of Vic's brother's wife. I can't remember.
Okay.
Yeah, most of them are things like that. I don't remember who this was.
Yeah.
Paul, of course. Oh, and Punch Green. Love Punch Green. Most of these.
Yeah, that's right. Right after this, Punch and Denny and Vic all flew to the Packers game in Los Angeles.
Yeah. And, you know, Greg and... Oh, and Paul with Barbara. I don't remember her last name. She was an odd character, but very, very capable. Just Vic and Dolores. There aren't too many.
Okay.
I'll put some names on if you want. If you need them.
Well, I think just with that, just in the kind of doing like this...
Yeah.
You've spoken here.
Yeah.
It works.
Good.
This is what I've learned is I'm panicking, trying to find a pen to write things down. It's like, oh, wait, I have it right here.
Boy, the pollen's awful today.
Yeah. Yeah. I got into town 11:30-ish. I was at the High Desert Museum and had lunch out there.
Oh, that's nice.
But it smells like summer.
Yeah, I know.
It's the first day of May and poof.
Weirdest weather, though. Well, what are you doing? He's going to fall on the couch. Come on. Anyway, you don't need that in your recording. Okay. What would you like to know?
Well, so tell me how you met this person, Vicatia.
Well, it was a little strange. I was getting a divorce, starting at the time to get a divorce, and he had been running an interior design business for several years. But I knew I couldn't send my son to college with that, and he was getting close to ready to go. So I was looking around for something to go back into the regular market. And a friend of mine, Mary Alice Ford, was county chairman for Washington County for the party. And she said, "Why don't you go talk to whatever his name was, who was the party chairman for the state. And I went and had lunch with him, and he said, why don't you go talk to Vic Atiyah? He can't give you a job because he's not doing anything but running for office, but maybe if you helped on his campaign a little, he could give you some ideas and leads. So I went and talked to Vic, and he was, at the time, Paul Newman, consultant, was going to be working with the campaign. But he was there, and I talked to both of them. I enjoyed it thoroughly. And a couple of days later, Vic called and said, how would you like to run my campaign? I said, oh, that might be fun. I didn't know enough to say no. I said, oh, that might be fun. I'd like to do that. So Paul Newman didn't come back until... See, he didn't... in January, he came back and he met with us and he said, now, I need to tell you, we are... I am not going to work with the campaign because there's no way he has a chance of winning. And you do not have enough money. You can't raise enough money to hire me. So I'll wish you luck. And then I kind of like you. So after the primary, after you lose the primary, you can call me and I'll help you get a job. Well, Vic asked me to run for almost no money. It's embarrassingly low. But I said, sure. And then, of course, one of the people on the campaign steering committee said, now, where's the campaign plan? I said, what's a campaign? I mean, that's how much I knew.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Well, I learned fast.
Yeah.
And Paul Newman, when he came back after the primary, he, and we stunned him. He said that I had probably learned more in that primary than most people learn in years of campaigning because it was so difficult and different. And so anyway, so I took over the campaign and started out. Vic had hired everybody by then. Danny, of course, was on. And some of his hires weren't as good as others, but they, you know, they're there. And it was kind of hard to get control because I came in with no experience and all these people he'd already hired. But it worked out pretty well. And fortunately, there were some great people. Sharon Page was fabulous. God, she was good. And she was very important to that campaign in 78. And I didn't bring anybody in myself, but I managed to gain control. And by the time the primary was over, I did have control of the thing. And but it was tough. And I do remember we had money was so short during that primary that in order to get poll results, we couldn't afford our own. We would, when there was an Oregonian coming out with a new poll in it, Denny and I would go down there and wait when they first brought out the papers in the morning.
Earliest edition,
and he'd stand there like this, like, you know, look. And there was that wonderful one. I have, I think I have a clipping in here. The one that I really loved. The, this was, we were really discouraged because I, they had tried to get Vic out of the race. People had
I'm going to ask you about that.
Anyway, this was...
Gaines on the call.
It's like, whoa.
That's the one where Vic and Tom looked and said, oh, well, Vic's going to win.
Well, I don't know what Tom said.
Tom
Atiyah, you mean?
No, Tom McCall.
He didn't admit that Vic...
he later admitted it. Yeah.
Well, he saw the trend. He was so nasty, but he was so nasty at the time. God, it was awful. He didn't run a campaign. He just
stood up.
Yeah. Well, he needed to be crowned. I could figure, with my minimal experience, I could figure that that wasn't going to work. And I also understood that a three-way primary was perfect for us because all we had to do was position Vic between Roger Martin and Tom McCall. Falling apart. I'm going to get rid of them. Okay, now here's your ball.
Well, that was all about the ball.
The primary was fascinating. The turning point was I don't know if Denny might even have told you about the story about flying down to Medford for the the three of them pulled mm-hmm. together. Mm-hmm. We had a debate, and we really were. I was so nervous about it. He was too,
mm-hmm.
because Vic refused to use a prepared speech,
mm-hmm.
and it always made me nervous. Anyway, down there, it wasn't a speech. It was questions and answers and brief statements.
Yeah.
And we knew we had it when Roger Martin did exactly what he had to do to make us win.
Mm-hmm.
And that the only way we could do it was if Tom McCall and Roger Martin went after each other,
mm-hmm.
and Vic was standing there. And he was perfect because he was so stolid, you know.
Yeah.
He was just...
Yeah.
And he was just there, statesmanlike in the
yeah.
middle, and the two of them went after, and we knew we'd won
yeah.
the primary. Because it was just so, that's what we needed.
Yeah.
And it worked. That's when that headline came out and it all went up
yeah.
and over. It
yeah.
was amazing. And no one thought we could do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But we did.
So what did you think of your chances before McCall got in?
Well, McCall got in... When did he get in? I can't
God,
remember.
It's January or
yeah,
early February.
Early,
yeah.
Yeah. And
it's like a month before the filing deadline.
See, that I figured he was going to anyway. There everybody was talking about how he was
uh-huh.
going to get in and that we wouldn't have nobody else would have a chance, but I don't know in a three-way race. That was one of the first things I knew about campaigns that it's a
we've
wonderful
got 14th of February.
Yeah.
So probably the 13th
yeah,
of February.
I knew he was going to get in.
Yeah.
And, well, and when the people took Vic aside at something down on the coast and said, you need to get out of the race,
mm-hmm.
They knew already that he was going to get in.
He was going to get in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it was better for us because if it was just Vic against Roger,
mm-hmm.
they were both seen as pretty conservative.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, Roger was more conservative, but... it wasn't clear at that
yeah,
point.
Yeah.
We had to make it clear. And one of the things Vic never forgave me in that thing, you notice there's some pictures of him with this horrible brown tweed sport coat that has lumpy shoulders. Did you hear the stories about that?
I've heard many stories about.
Oh, God.
Denny's favorite is that you guys wanted to break in and mysteriously.
Yeah, well,
like,
that was because the
camel
sport coat.
Sports coats and short sleeve shirts or something
oh,
would be gone.
That, and the pants were too short.
Uh huh.
I mean, I'm seriously, we talked about it, and
yeah.
I finally threatened Vic. This is terrible. Well,
mm-hmm.
first I got very logical, and I wrote this thing about positioning.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things you have to do is to position yourself well here is. Image,
mm-hmm.
and you have to appear strong and statesmanlike, which
mm-hmm.
you are,
mm-hmm.
and in between the wild
mm-hmm.
Tom McCall and the nasty
mm-hmm.
Roger Martin.
Mm-hmm.
And so here's what we can do.
Mm-hmm.
First, we get you new glasses. And do you know the old glasses? Oh, God. We got new glasses.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he grumbled and griped, and I don't want to wear them. I said, just for the campaign, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Well, okay. And all the women started saying, oh, Vic, you look so handsome in your new glasses. Worked just the way I expected.
Mm-hmm.
And I explained, okay, also, you need to wear sharp contrasting colors
mm-hmm.
that make you look really sharp.
Mm-hmm.
I said, dark suit, white shirt preferably,
mm-hmm.
light colored shirt, or light blue, something with a contrast, because I said, frankly, some of these outfits you wear... no one can see you against a paneled wall
because yeah.
you're brown from head to toe.
Yeah.
And I said, that tweed jacket with the lumpy shoulder. Dolores agreed.
Mm-hmm.
Dolores said, if you could get rid of that, make him stop wearing it. I said, I would break in, yeah, and
yeah,
if I could. And the shirts, so I threatened. One day I got so mad at him. I said, Vic, you're wearing a short sleeve shirt again. He said, well, it's more comfortable. And I said, you know why
mm-hmm.
you have to wear the long sleeve shirts. I said, if you do that again, I'm going to get together with Dolores and cut the cuffs off of all your long sleeves and sew them inside the jackets so you can't. He didn't like that. And then a couple weeks later, he came in and it was warm out and I was wearing an eyelet blouse,
mm-hmm.
short sleeve.
Mm-hmm.
He said, well, I like that. He said, I can't wear short sleeves at all and you're wearing a short sleeve shirt with holes in it. So good. Well, I said, you can do that when you are running for office.
Yeah.
So that was hilarious. Anyway, we got him fixed up.
Yeah.
Most candidates, I swear, they all are like that.
Yeah, and it's interesting because one of the things that's really well studied in political science is the C-SPAN effect.
Yeah.
You know, all of a sudden people stop wearing those things that made the chroma key blow up.
Yeah.
And they, blue, white, red, what some combination, we're all patriotic, pins or not.
Yeah, I know.
But yet out on the stump.
Oh, God.
Unless there's somebody like you, mm-hmm. Hitting over the head.
Slade
They'll just
Gorton,
wear the darnest
Slade
thing.
Slade Gorton, when he was running for the Senate in Washington State, mm-hmm. I was sent in to work with the campaign manager. I was sent in by the National Party
mm-hmm.
to try to help him mm-hmm. running against... what's his name? Sorry, the man. Oh, the long time.
Senator. Oh, Magnuson.
Yeah, Magnuson.
Yeah.
Anyway, and so there were things he had to do.
Yeah.
He was seen as a little Eastern.
Yeah.
Always the striped tie, always the loafers and all of that sort of thing. So the rule was no more loafers during the campaign for mm-hmm. these events. The lace-up shoes.
Mm-hmm.
He would do anything to avoid lace-up shoes. I mean, they get fixated on
mm-hmm.
this. So, but we had a driver who was very good.
Mm-hmm.
And one day he came into the headquarters, because he was living in Olympia at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And he came into the headquarters and he said, "Guess what? I forgot my lace-up shoes." And the driver said, "No, you didn't. I put them in the trunk of the car." Yeah. He may really have to. Sometimes campaign management is like teaching kindergarten.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
It's
keeping them on the right track. It's sort of frustrating, but it's fun.
Yeah.
It's fun.
Yeah.
And we did have fun. We did some very silly things.
Like what?
You're not going to put all these in.
It's archival. It goes in the archives.
Okay.
I snip stuff out to use for my own thing.
Well, Denny may have told you some of these things. Like the time because there's so much stress and pressure that you blow sometimes.
Yeah.
Once we went across, there was a one of those weird parking structures across diagonally from the headquarters where the car goes up on a little elevator.
Yeah.
Remember those?
Yeah.
Well, one of our people on the staff, it wasn't Danny, somebody climbed up there and put a Tia for Governor stickers on every car up there.
Great.
No one knew who did it.
Uh-huh.
And the best one, though, was the time toward the end when we had been down town putting together filming a last spot
mm-hmm.
and somebody looked out and said, "Oh, look, that's the governor's car out there."
Mm-hmm.
Somebody, Denny may have been aware of it, but
mm-hmm.
I don't know. I thought it was Paul Newman who went out and did it. Denny might have helped
mm-hmm.
putting a bumper sticker on the front of the governor's car. And no one noticed it in his staff, but he came in to Salem the next morning.
He's driving up and down the freeway.
He pulled into the Capitol in this car, and his press secretary was standing there on the Capitol steps and was just having a fit. Here he comes with the Tia sticker on his car. That was
wonderful.
So wonderful. I just loved that. Somewhere I have pictures of that.
Yeah.
It was so perfect. And Bob Straub never even knew.
Yeah. That's typical Bob, too.
Oh, yes. I know.
We
did some strange things.
My dad was a county commissioner in Jackson County, and he was elected in 1974. And the main thing I remember about the bumper stickers, which were kind of a mod thing, because it was what you did. The stick'em was so awful that my brother and I spent 6 months going to supporters with turpentine.
Oh, you can't get them off. They were terrible.
Horrible.
I know it. They were just awful.
Just horrible.
Yeah, I know. Anyway, but we had fun with things like that.
Yeah, that's wonderful.
Yeah, we did some other things too. Oh, the one about the ad. I bet Denny may have told you because he was involved in that one. I bet. There was Paul Newman wanted us to do this ad that we all thought was really terrible. It was this TV ad, and it was something about the it was the shell game, and you know, moving around. Did Denny tell you this story? And we were not enthusiastic, but Paul said, you have to do it. This could be the difference in here. So we were putting this together, and it was just obvious. Paul was doing the shell part with these halves of coconuts. He should have shaved the coconuts because he had these bitten nails. And it looked like this monster coming down from the sky attacking the native huts. So someone in the campaign set that that thing to what was his name, Martin Denny, Yellowbird.
Oh yeah.
We just loved that. I know Denny knew about it, but he may have forgotten. But, oh God, that was funny. I mean, that's the thing about campaigns.
Oh yeah.
Paul was so mad when he discovered we didn't do it. Didn't use it.
Yeah.
Too bad, Paul.
That's the way
anyway.
It goes.
Yeah. It was fun.
And he came back 4 years later, too.
Yeah, that's right.
So tell me, I mean, this is a campaign that is run, the contacts are the contacts from 4 years earlier. So you've got piles of volunteers.
Yeah.
How much were they a part of what you were doing?
They were huge.
Uh-huh.
Sharon Page was volunteer coordinator, and she was really good. And we organized the state by county. Every county had to have a chairman for us and a finance person. And it got difficult because we were determined, all 36 counties. I can't remember. I think I was the chairman for Wallowa County.
Yeah.
We did things like that. Yeah. But the volunteers were incredibly organized. We really worked that. And they all felt like they were part of it. It's over here. And they really, you know, they really got into it. In fact, there were people who expected to get state appointments because they had been...
Because they've been volunteers.
Yeah. This is the primary, I think.
Yeah. No, that might... Because that's the other article is Straub. This news article. The other one is about Straub's team.
Yeah.
And the women in it. Yeah. So that'd be...
Yeah, but this is...
Oh, this is... Okay.
The handbook.
Okay.
Or but was that the primary or the general? I think this is the primary. I don't know. It's all the different functions for volunteers. These were their handbook. And this one is, somehow I must have lost the cover. But this, I think, this is probably the general election stuff. Operation Grassroots. Yeah, this is the same thing for the general.
For the general.
More detailed.
Yeah, fantastic.
And you can have these.
Great, thanks.
And this, I don't know. This was the one that they, this was what they kept at the volunteer headquarters at each county also. They had, these are answers to questions, names of staff. They all had, were very... They should, we all had the feeling they should be, feel like they're part of it.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so they knew who we were. They could call in. We had a special phone line they could call in on. That was a real pain, but we did.
Yeah.
And we did the ultimate volunteer campaign. I mean, it was. And this is what they had. So they knew everybody who was doing everything.
Yeah.
And
that's amazing.
It was really a good organization. We had, how many did we have? We had an enormous number. I've forgotten now how many we had. 5,000, 10,000. There was I can't find the article. There was an article in the Register Guard after the primary about the campaign that called it the greatest volunteer organization in three quarters of a century. I think it was in the Register Guard. You might check on it. It was a great article.
Yeah, I know there's one, Wayne Thompson
said
he went and pulled cards. Yeah, yeah. I can't find that article, though. So
yeah, that was the
gotta dig
Oregonian,
for that.
Right?
Yeah, yeah.
The Register Guard in Eugene
mm-hmm.
was really enthusiastic. I kept it, and I don't know where it went, because it was just, it said it was the most amazing campaign they'd
mm-hmm.
ever seen, and
mm-hmm.
just in, even in the primary. Because what we did was... we used smoke and mirrors as well as real
yeah.
people, because in the primary, we didn't have a full volunteer organization, but we had people's names, we had phone banks calling and saying, I'm calling on behalf of the chairman and all that. I mean, we had all this stuff we were doing, and the Register Guard people said, my God, you were contacting everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And then we were also... We did things in each county. In some areas, we did it in each precinct. We had door-to-door.
Mm-hmm.
We targeted neighborhoods where press people lived.
Well, there you go.
Yeah,
that's the magnifying effect.
We went door-to-door in the neighborhoods where they lived.
Yeah, very nice.
It was fun.
Yeah. Oh,
they thought we had the most amazing thing ever.
Yeah.
No, we didn't in the primary, but in the general we did.
Yeah.
I don't know how many thousand people we had in the general. We had a lot.
Now,
I knew.
When you switched from, I mean, there's still more primary questions, but when you switched from the primary where McCall is now defeated, because I know for the donors, you know, a lot of like the timber money people were staying out because they wanted to save their money to defeat McCall in the general.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden it's like, huh, and Bob Straub was just ticked off that it didn't go to him.
I know.
But did you also get kind of McCall people coming over? Or was it
not just
generally just more people because it was a general election?
The McCall people really didn't.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, Roger Martin, yes.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, he was great. He came in and afterwards he said, okay, what would you like from my campaign?
Mm-hmm.
I
you
said
Greg
Walden.
Exactly. Yeah.
She said Greg Walden. I said, yes, absolutely. That's what I want from your campaign.
Uh-huh.
He had just turned 21, and he was good.
Yeah.
He was better than Denny, really, at that point.
Mm-hmm.
For press.
Because
he was, that was, I mean, having grown up basically working with a radio station and public stuff, and he was just so fast with that stuff.
Yeah.
He was really good.
Yeah.
So anyway, we did some amazing things.
Yeah. So in the primary, what do you know about the meeting with Roger Martin?
Which meeting?
The one where they were supposed, one of them was supposed to pull out
of
the race.
Well, basically it was mostly they were pushing Vic. I mean,
mm-hmm.
it was people from Vic's not just steering committee, it was his close campaign committee.
Mm-hmm.
And they were saying, you need to get out.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that was really, talk about a rotten trick. There
mm-hmm.
were a couple people on that in that group who
mm-hmm.
said, you know, you just really can't do this.
Mm-hmm.
And we can't raise you the money.
Mm-hmm.
And it, oh boy, he was really mad.
Mm-hmm.
It was really upsetting.
Yeah.
But we weren't there, but I heard quite a bit from people who were.
Yeah.
So it was just really nasty. And everyone said at that point we couldn't win, but darn
mm-hmm.
it, we could.
Mm-hmm.
We knew it.
Mm-hmm.
Some of us,
mm-hmm.
not all of us,
mm-hmm.
some of us knew we could do it. And it was right that we did it, because Vic was good
mm-hmm.
and terribly capable, not political in the usual way,
mm-hmm.
because he was not exactly a thriller.
Yeah.
But he was so solid,
yeah.
and people needed someone solid they could rely on.
Mm-hmm.
The situation economically was such, it was just a little uncomfortable,
mm-hmm.
and interest rates, and just
mm-hmm.
you know, just a little bit, and he was so solid, and so everybody, you know, you could trust him.
Yeah.
And we did some things that helped him, and I loved it. Sharon Page did this. We had had a meeting over at their house
mm-hmm.
at Vic and Dolores. And we looked, and Sharon said, what is... There was the framed invitation to come to the... what was it? The Green Bay Packers, wasn't it?
Oh, the contract?
Yeah. And to the offering contract.
Yeah.
And nobody knew that. See, no, he said, I never mentioned that.
Oh, well, nobody knew that? Oh, my God.
Not until then. Not until Sharon Page.
Yeah.
Well, I said, oh, my God, we need to, and this is the kind of thing we need to know about you, Vic. Oh, well, I never thought about mentioning it.
Mm-hmm.
He never had.
Yeah.
So Sharon put out this newsletter thing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it was embarrassing. Sharon had so much enthusiasm. Mm-hmm. She was just great. But she really got a little dramatic. In fact, we teased her about this. She wrote this article about Vic, background article, of all these things about him. And at some point in there, it was after the football thing, but, oh, the his brothers being in prison camp in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, and then fate entered the scene. And I was like, oh, no. And we always, we had this plaque that we gave to Sharon that said F-E-T-S.
The scene.
And any time somebody was writing something for the campaign that got a little overdone, I would say F-E-T-S. It was just wonderful. But she was so enthusiastic. But it was good. I mean, people hadn't heard this stuff about Vic.
Yeah.
And how he came home because he didn't finish school because he had to go and work in the business and his brothers. And he could have played for the Green Bay Packers.
Yeah.
It was amazing.
Yeah. You know, I've looked at the letters he got from professional football teams. He actually would have had a better deal with New York Giants.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't ever see
They would pay him less per game,
uh-huh.
but they guaranteed him, whereas the Packers, it was only if you actually played.
Oh.
So it was like, I would have, but they didn't give him a contract either. So.
No. Well, it's just, you know, it's fascinating to me, the things that people don't tell you.
Yeah.
And I've had candidates who do it. Well, why didn't you mention that? Well, I don't know. I didn't think about it.
Yeah.
And my own father, I discovered when I was probably in my 40s or 50s.
Mm-hmm.
He was on a farm team for St. Louis baseball.
Mm-hmm.
And they wanted him to come up and play.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't go up to the majors because he couldn't afford it because he had a wife and a baby. That was me.
Yeah.
And so he had to turn him down because there was no money in it in those days.
Yeah.
And you just, you know, they don't, oh, yeah, I didn't I ever tell you that? Yeah, no?
Yeah.
But it was wonderful. Vic was very much that way. He just
didn't
blow his own horn enough.
Mm-hmm.
But it worked for him because people trusted him.
Yeah.
And
One thing in the primary, I mean, when he loses in 74, he feels good about himself.
Yeah.
And, he never decided to run for office until too late.
Yeah.
But in any case, but all during that 4 years, he would go to Dorchester and people would stand up and cheer.
Yeah.
And he was more visible traveling a bit. He was less parochial, focused on Washington County, being more around the state. So when he's in doing the campaign in 78, did you get a sense that people did know who he was?
Oh yeah.
When he came in,
he had a name ID of 90-some%.
Wow.
Favorable.
Wow.
He really was up there. Everybody knew who he was. Now it wasn't all favorable, but
96%
of the people could identify Vicatius.
Yeah.
The thing is, he told me when I started. He said, you know, the thing that really was horrifying about that 74 campaign was that I had a campaign manager who did things without telling me, spent money without telling me, and ran a huge debt for the campaign.
Oh, yeah.
He said, I don't ever want you to do that.
Yeah.
I said, don't worry.
Yeah.
Because he said, no, that is just wrong.
Yeah.
So.
Denny has exactly the same story for 92.
Oh, I figured.
Yeah.
I figured.
Yeah.
But, he was very well known.
Mm-hmm.
But he was also perceived, if you look at polling stuff that I don't have any polls anymore, he was perceived as conservative and not terribly interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And that's part of why we had to change his image and show him as who he really was. That football thing was important.
Yeah.
That and other things about him that he never talked about because he had to show people.
Yeah.
Not top brag or anything, but just be who he really was.
Yeah.
And that was the biggest thing we accomplished.
Huh. fascinating because when you think about the football, 3 years later, Portland Interscholastic League starts a Hall of Fame for sports, and he's one of the in the opening class with two professional football players, like the coach of the Seahawks, and it's like, but and as Vic told it, you know, my football career gets better and better the higher and higher my office goes.
Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it? Yeah,
because he never played varsity football.
Yeah, but he has that sense. He sees and hears things that he has that. That sense of humor that is very
he gets that funny
dry.
Little little smile, a little twinkle in his eye, and it's like, you know, you're whatever.
Yeah, I know. That's great.
He was wonderful.
But
at that.
I've got to find some of those. You know, if you haven't got all of those clippings that.
Well, we have when he's in office, we got they did clippings in gigantic books.
But I mean the primaries.
The primaries are tough.
Primaries and the general. Yeah. I've got to look. I know I've got. An album thing that has some of those old clippings, and they were really good.
Mm-hmm.
I'll go through. I'm in the process of cleaning out my garage.
Yeah.
And I've got boxes of books and boxes of old. I have a whole filing cabinet out there.
Yeah.
Because I can't, you know, I can't fit it in here.
Yeah.
I have my office is in the corner there.
Mm-hmm.
So. Anyway.
That's having just come from my 80-year-old father and his. Relatively new 77-year-old wife as they put carpet in, moving furniture.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot of things I'm looking at saying, you know, these books, really, if you're not going to put them on the shelves, don't give them to me. Take them to the book place and say, here.
It's so hard, though.
I know. But it's not books that are forever theirs. They would just find old books that they liked.
Oh.
And it's like, you know, you're not going to read it. It's a decoration.
Oh, no.
Ouch.
I read and read and read. I have managed to control myself.
Mm-hmm.
When I left Virginia, I got rid of, I think, 1,500 books, something like that.
Yeah.
I gave most of them away, and I sold a few.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Yep.
It was painful.
Yeah.
And there are still some that I wish I'd been able to keep. But, of course, this is just one part of my books.
Yeah.
But.
It's still amazing to me. I mean, I've been teaching now for 25 years, and there's still times I say, you know, I need that book from my freshman year in college.
Yeah.
And I have it. Mm-hmm. And I look at it, and we use it.
There we go. I used to have all of those. I've gradually weaned myself of a lot of them, but I still have some of the history and political science stuff from college.
Yeah.
And glad I do, because the books they're putting out now are just pathetic. They're full of colored pictures.
I know. I don't use textbooks at all anymore, just because they're just, there's no point. And they're too expensive.
Oh, God.
It's stunning.
I know it.
It's like, well, will the ancillary materials be good for this? It's like, no.
Yeah.
I'm going to give my students a list of articles that are online from academic journals. That's the reading list.
That's what I do a lot of that.
Ugh.
I have some books. Most of the books I assign are for all my courses I teach are paperbacks.
Yeah.
And a bunch of things that are... resources you should keep if you're going into the field.
Exactly.
And lots and lots and lots
there's nothing like a good budgeting book.
Yeah.
Boy, you keep that forever. The econ books you can get rid of.
Oh, that was the first thing I got. You know, I went back to school for, it was just a whim. I was kind of tired of politics.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I liked it, but I just, all the travel I was doing. And I, in 2005, I sat down with Jim Thurber, who was running the center. You know,
he's actually good friends with Glenn Wood, who I mentioned.
Oh, okay.
And I met Jim because he comes out. He's really interested in mobile mail.
Yeah.
So he's out here occasionally.
I know that. He was my favorite person there at the AAU. Anyway, I said, Jim, I really want to get another degree.
Mm-hmm.
He said, why do you want that? I said, I want to find out if I can teach the things that my students are supposed to be learning from me. And or I mean, if I can do that.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, oh, you don't need that. Because this was before I went to George Mason. And he said, just forget it. It'd be a waste. And I said, but what if I wanted, I mean, even just a master's in something different. He said, oh, well, I said, I'm not going to do it here. He said, why don't you go talk to Kathy Rutter at George Mason School of Public Policy. And she's the dean over there. And so I did, and I really liked her. And the nice thing was that George Mason School of Public Policy is with the law school in Arlington rather than out in the Tules. And she convinced me to come there, and just, I had a wonderful time. I loved it. I had more fun. I could have stayed in school forever, but they wouldn't let me keep getting more master's degrees. I didn't want to get a PhD in public policy because... I was having fun taking. To me, the course catalog was a smorgasbord. I loved that. I didn't want to focus on a narrow area. So I said, no, Kathy, I'm not going to stay for it. I did get the Master's of Public Policy, and I was in two honor societies. I wasn't that in Stanford, but I had a 3.85 average. I was great. Old. I was the oldest student.
Great.
But I had a ball. I started a student-run journal of public policy. That was the most fun I've had in years.
Yeah.
So.
That's great.
Anyway, I don't know why I told you about that. There was some reason.
Well, academic stuff, books, that kind of stuff.
Books.
Yeah.
Yes.
Just so you know, I was undergrad at Stanford.
You were?
Yeah. So the books I'm talking about from freshman year are, you know, from that. So.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
When were you at Stanford?
It's funny because writing about Vic, that's when I did not live in Oregon. I left to go to college in 77. And I didn't move back until I re-met someone from my high school class and we got married in 1989. So I moved back here in 1990.
Oh my gosh.
And in the interim, never thought I would ever live in Oregon ever again.
Oh, I thought that when I went back east, that, oh my God, I'm out of Oregon.
Yeah. And then, you know, life happens.
Well, and it's, I came to Bend because I was so tired of traffic and tension and stress I mean, I'd done it for so long. I was there 30 years. And I thought, no, I'm not going to do it anymore. People thought I was insane. I said, what? Yes, why would you go there? And I said, Bend, Oregon is wonderful. I'm not going to live in Portland anymore.
It's amazing when we have job openings. I mean, they're all swamped, but about half of them are all people who are somehow from the West Coast and are trying to figure out how the hell to get back. From Ohio or Florida or wherever.
And there's a lot of them from the East, from the Northeast.
I've
met them all over. At Home Depot, even.
But
the reason I lucked out, I got smart for a change in my old age. I had the opportunity to take get a grant to take a special course at AU in distance learning. And teaching distance learning with different techniques. And I took that and converted one of my courses there, and two of them, into the speech writing course and the other writing course, into distance learning, and it worked great, and I loved it. I was so surprised.
Yeah, that's great.
Because I have a very interactive classroom, but I get to know the students better in the distance learning. So that's why I was able, I thought, heck, I've got enough money. If I sell it, I sold that house in Alexandria for a, God, I've never made a profit before on a house, but boy, that one I did. I sold it for 700 and some thousand when I bought it for 200.
There you go.
God, gosh, that's scary. And then came out here and at the worst of the housing crisis.
Right. Yeah. So you got deals.
I just, my gosh, I could buy this place and I'd like, it's perfect for me. 200,000.
Yeah. Fantastic.
Yeah. Fully air-conditioned. Everything.
Yeah.
Oh, it's perfect. Great. Anyway.
So let's get back to 78.
Yes,
so,
I'm sorry.
So, primary
would
night.
Would you like some coffee or just water?
Water would be great.
You want bottled water? Or maybe I have the water thing in the refrigerator if you want.
Out of the faucet is fine unless you think it's poison.
Oh, probably is. No. I usually use the faucet thing in the refrigerator. Very handy. This new refrigerator is different. I don't like the outer faucet thing.
Yeah.
But this has filtered water.
Oh, well, that's very, very nice.
Isn't that handy?
Yeah, we never get those things because they tend to break down and they're so hard to fix.
Well, that's why.
It is rated the number one dog-friendly city in the country.
Oh, great.
We have more dog parks than any other place. Yes,
wow.
7 or 8 large dog, off-leash dog parks.
So, Bo, I'm not going to play ball with you right now.
So primary night.
Yeah.
Did Roger Martin come to see you guys to concede phone calls? I know we'll get into, you know, going to Tom and that kind of stuff, but
phone call? Yeah.
Okay. And then does Vic actually go over to McCall's campaign?
I think I'm trying to remember, because I went with him somewhere. I think so.
Okay. He does a sort of getting there, and not only was the media there, but Tom had been drinking.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
And it was...
very drunk.
Yeah.
It was at one of the hotels. I can't remember.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was bad.
Yeah.
Interesting little side thing on that campaign. A few years ago, I was... Pat and Bob Carpenter's house at Chesapeake Beach, and they had a party, and a whole bunch of people from Oregon came, because Pat Jardine had lived here for so long. Anyway, Greg Wallen was there, and Mark Cushing was there. Hadn't seen him since the campaign in 78. He proceeded, honest to God, this was maybe not even 10 years ago, just a few years ago. He argued with me about our winning that race. He said, well, it was just you got lucky and all this stuff. And what we did was exactly right. Our attacking Tom McCall was perfect. That's exactly the only way we could have done it. I thought, you fool, that's the only way you could lose. And he still believes that 100% that he did it right.
Talking with Roger Martin, you know, talks about he had all these young guys.
Yes.
And Mark Cushing was his campaign manager or something. Yeah. But he said he doesn't talk to Mark anymore.
Well, I won't blame him. Mark is arrogant.
Yeah.
Still.
Yeah.
I shouldn't say this with that recording.
Oh, it's, you not believe the things that are on here.
Oh, No,
I talked to a 92-year-old in Roseburg a couple of days ago. And he was dropping the F-bomb about every time. Like, well, you're a World War II vet. You just go for it, and it's in the archives.
Oh, dear. No, the primary... I was so stressed. Primary night, I went home and threw up. I had just been so tense through this whole thing.
We
all were very... very tense. And the general, of course, was even worse.
Yeah, absolutely.
It was so, it got so bad in the fall that at a certain point, Greg Walden and a couple other people came into my office one morning and they said, get your coat on, you're going to the beach. Because I had a beach house at Lincoln City. I said, I can't go to the beach, I have work. They said, you need a vacation so badly, and we need a vacation from you for a day or so, or two. This weekend, you're going to be at the beach, at your beach house. And they took me to the beach and left me there without a car. I couldn't go anywhere because they said it's just, you know, this it's got to be too much. Anyway, but we had a good bunch.
During that summer, people talked about there was some drama about what McCall would do. Endorse Straub, or stay neutral,
or
what?
Run in the,
is it independent? So, what do you?
He talked about endorsing Straub. And that just, I mean, couldn't do anything about it. So we just kept going. He was drinking so much at that point that he just was not in great shape. But he didn't get actively involved for Straub, but he was supporting him. And Straub could have won re-election if Well, one thing did well, I'm sure Denny must have told you about the crisis in the fall. What was his name? Dave. He was a Democratic consultant who was famous out of New York, who was supposed to be the genius
mm-hmm.
party politics,
mm-hmm.
and Straub campaign hired him.
Mm-hmm.
And he right away spotted the one thing that we couldn't get Vic to change that
mm-hmm.
that was a weakness for him, and that was that people thought he was indecisive.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been, and he said, oh, no, I'm doing fine. You know,
mm-hmm.
everybody loves me now, and we have a huge campaign by fall.
Mm-hmm.
And Dave, what was his name, came right, I mean, they came straight at him. With
mm-hmm.
ads all over the radio
mm-hmm.
on weak, indecisive.
Mm-hmm.
And boy, did that hit.
Mm-hmm.
Because I had committed to do some tracking polling.
Yeah.
And it was relatively new then.
Yeah.
And, we had that machine that... Denny brought in. What were those things that before regular faxes, they were, or it was a telefax or something. It was very slow.
Yeah, yeah.
It was a page every 6 minutes or something
yeah.
ridiculous. Anyway, so they would send us the results of the daily tracking
mm-hmm.
on that machine, and Denny and Greg and I would be kind of waiting. and when that, the bottom dropped out. And I remember I called Paul Newman and I said, Paul, we got a problem here. The bottom has just dropped out of our numbers.
Mm-hmm.
He said, well, how could... And I said, this is what they've done. They did
mm-hmm.
exactly what we were hoping Vic could do something about and would
mm-hmm.
ahead of time. And we did. That's when we went... we really went strong. Vic... I'm sure Denny must have told you the story about the situation where Greg Walden got in trouble because Paul Newman convinced him to quit, run up to the Oregonian and take this.
He didn't tell me that Greg was involved.
Oh, Greg.
Yeah.
That's why Greg was never in the office with the...
Uh-huh.
I mean, it was horrible. No,
yeah.
It wasn't Greg's fault.
Yeah.
Paul Newman
oh,
did
yeah.
it.
Yeah, Paul Newman did
yeah.
it, yeah.
Yeah, he got Greg. Yeah. He said, yeah... Take this, and I hadn't seen it. Vic hadn't seen it.
Yeah.
Oh, the next morning, Vic comes into my office, and they're just like,
yeah.
you know, I was just Denny and I both just sitting there. Just, oh, and Greg wasn't even there at the
mm-hmm.
time, but I said, Vic, I really think you did have to say that, and it was important.
Mm-hmm.
He said, I did, it was wrong, and you know that put
mm-hmm.
me in. He said, I've got to retract it. I said, Vic, what you've got to do is not just retract it. You have to fire me. Because
mm-hmm.
if your manager can't control the campaign,
mm-hmm.
then you've got a problem.
Mm-hmm.
And so you've got to say, you know, it was
mm-hmm.
my fault and you have to fire me. He said, no, I don't have to do that. I said, yes, you do.
Mm-hmm.
That's the only way you can deal with this. If you insist on retracting this, it makes you look very weak, which is what they're saying you are.
Mm-hmm.
And so you've got to blame me for it. That's the only way you can survive.
Mm-hmm.
And he just argued and argued and finally said, okay. And thank goodness he said okay. And
mm-hmm.
then, so we did that and we got tough. Did you hear about did Denny tell you about the ad, the TV ad with Roger Martin and... what's his name? LB Day?
Mm-hmm.
Oh,
mm-hmm.
God. It was so funny. We decided we had to make Vic look like tough people really
yeah.
respected him.
Yeah.
So we had Roger Martin and LB Day sitting
mm-hmm.
there in these black suits in front of a brick wall talking about how wonderful Vic was, and he was just the best.
Mm-hmm.
And these women campaign supporters called, what is going on? It looks like two mafia hitmen endorsing Vic. Yes!
We have just within the past 6 weeks digitized all the ads that we have.
Really?
So,
oh.
And now the digitized, they're all on a hard drive,
yeah.
but they're being transferred so we can all look at them on the web.
Oh, that's
but,
great.
Yeah.
I have some old tapes of them,
mm-hmm.
but not all of them. But that was the most effective ad because it was just so startling. I mean, every day, God.
Yeah.
They both looked just mean. But that's the kind of thing we had to do to get back.
Yeah, yeah. So you ran the last campaign to defeat an incumbent governor in Oregon.
Yeah.
At what point did you begin to
campaign
think,
for the first era of America?
Exactly, exactly.
Yeah.
At what point did you begin to know that you could do this, that you were going to carry this off? Was it at the beginning? You know, because Straub, it's like he never gelled with people.
We were very worried. We were doing really well in building through the summer and all this. We had the billboard campain where what we did was we started out with a small showing, 25% showing statewide, then 50, then and it kept growing. And people thought, my gosh, look, everybody's climbing on. And there were stories in the newspaper about all these people are joining Vicatia's campaign. It's everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And we did bandwagon effect.
Yeah, yeah.
But that stuff by Dave, what was his name?
Yes.
Killed it. Just killed us.
It's in the Straub biography.
Yeah,
so
it just killed us.
Yeah.
And that's how we had to really work to come back, and we did. We really worked, and we checked the results from the tracking every morning. Just God, please! And you could see it would start moving up. Come on, then we'd hit it harder and do some more things to really. And Vic knew something was wrong when the polling. Oh, and that was something. Greg and I were dealing with the results from the tracking at that point, and we did something that wasn't totally honest. We, Vic was working constantly. He was exhausted and traveling constantly, and we were trying to get him to take breaks. We had Paul taking the fishing rods with him so that it was just, and when the bottom fell out of it, Greg and I said, oh my God, we can't tell Vic this. So we took some of the old stuff and showed him when he asked us. And he went out to Eastern Oregon, came back from that trip, and came into my office and said, okay, I want to know why you've been lying to me. He said, I can see it out there. I can feel people are not as happy with me, and you're not telling me the truth about this. I mean, that was brilliant.
Yeah.
No one else knew.
Yeah.
Greg and I and Denny, I think, but no, I don't even know if Denny knew that at that point, that we were...
He had such an amazing sense. Oh. There's only one election in his entire career that he didn't know if he was going to win or lose.
Yeah.
And that's when I think it's when he moved to the Senate, and he drove to the party not knowing if he was going to win or lose, and it was fine, and he inched it out.
Yeah.
But it's just amazing.
We were really worried in the fall. We really, we were sitting there saying... What do we do? We can't let him lose because we felt so responsible. It was so important to him.
Yeah.
We thought we can't let that happen to him. So we fought like mad to get back up there because he needed to have it.
Yeah.
And we thought, what do we do if he loses? And it's But then then we saw it coming back.
Yeah.
And all sorts of things started happening. I got this call from one of the Democratic committee men who was very active in the Democratic Party, and he said, would you like the list of names and addresses and phone numbers of all of the Democratic committee people in the state? I thought that'd be nice. And we sent them all a letter inviting them to join join us. It was wonderful. It just was
great.
I love
Straub
that.
People
can
word.
We were just trying to get, that bandwagon thing going again toward the end. And it did help.
Yeah.
And with those phone bags we had everywhere.
Yeah.
And we had them where we didn't even need them.
Yeah.
And not just phone bags, we had materials. There was so much. I've never done that much in a campaign since then. And it was just, everyone was talking about it. I mean, everybody got calls. It was just, and they weren't even necessarily calls saying vote for Vic. They were just mm-hmm. different kinds of calls about mm-hmm. from the campaign.
Mm-hmm.
And they were just, everybody was overwhelmed at all the stuff we had.
Yeah. So with your campaign plan going in, how closely did you stick to it? You know, you're coordinating, you've got television going on, radio going on, you've got the volunteers going on. So did you stick to the plan, or were you jogged off of it because of the poll numbers? Or
I was prepared to be off of it. Uh-huh. I mean, the campaign was not all that definite,
mm-hmm.
and it was left room for... The point was that, you know, we had a goal,
mm-hmm.
and at least to me, I knew what the strategy had to be. How could we win
mm-hmm.
these things that had to happen, like it was important that Roger Martin and Tom McCall get into it and these mm-hmm. other things happen, and that Vic is perceived... Oh, when we did one of the debate things that we did in the campaign
mm-hmm.
Early on,
mm-hmm.
I don't remember which newspaper, but there was an article about it that said that said something, not even just about that, but talked about Vic Attia, a moderate Republican candidate mm-hmm. in the primary.
Mm-hmm.
Got it. I mean,
highlight that. Put it in a brochure now.
Debbie Nurse. Oh my God. Yeah, moderate campaign candidate. That was so wonderful mm-hmm. because it worked,
yeah.
And we put a lot into that image thing, but the whole point, what I had as a campaign plan wasn't necessarily what everybody else would do,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
but the point was that it told where we were going and how we get there, the strategy mm-hmm. and the message of mm-hmm. the campaign. Mm-hmm. We knew what the message was.
Mm-hmm.
When I taught, and I still have taught fairly recently, strategy and message for campaigns,
mm-hmm.
I have a little graph thing that looks like a small what do you call it? Anyway, it has boxes with the strategy is who is going to be persuadable to vote for you and why,
mm-hmm.
and then the message is why
mm-hmm.
Vic Attia is the best choice.
Mm-hmm.
And then from there, the tactics, how we get that message out.
Mm-hmm.
That's the basic campaign mm-hmm. plan, and everything mm-hmm. comes from that. And our thing was to be the biggest volunteer organization they'd ever seen.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
To show, and the bandwagon effect, to show that people loved Vic Attia, and they would do anything for him, and he deserved that kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
And just as there were a lot of things that happened around
right.
it, and a lot of things that we did that we were able to do, even that we hadn't planned, that we would add on.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't do it instead of.
Mm-hmm.
We would try to get to the level we needed in advertising, and that was something that was a little difficult since we had no money in the primary.
Yeah.
We had to use some techniques that I've used since. We would offer people the opportunity to put radio ads on, not theirs, but ours, that we would
mm-hmm.
made the ads
mm-hmm.
and said, if you want, you know, you can sponsor one.
So it'd be Moreland Plumbing.
Yeah.
Pays for an ATM
or
something.
It couldn't be Moreland.
Yeah, yeah, but whatever it was.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
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 And so in the primary, yeah. people did that.
Yeah.
And some did in the general.
Uh-huh.
The other thing that helped, I think it was in the primary, when we had, yeah, because we had been at Dorchester, it was not too long before the primary, we were really, really hurting for money.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember Dale, who was the advertising person, he said, you've got to have these ads.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, I said, we don't have the money. He said, you've got to get the money and put these on. It's mm-hmm. important. Well, the mail came, and I opened this envelope, and it was a check for $5,000.
there's some ads.
I said, what's going on here? It's not fake.
Yeah.
It was this man from the lumber industry somewhere who had not been involved in politics, but saw Vicati and met him and was really impressed with him, so he sent $5,000.
Huh.
I was like, oh my God,
yeah.
My life is saved. I can live.
Yeah.
I was just, that was the most exciting thing. I just couldn't believe it.
Mm-hmm.
Showed everybody in the world, $5,000. Nowadays, yeah. $5,000 is nothing.
No.
But it was, that was a lot.
Yeah.
For no apparent reason. Oh, okay. Hell, and he said, Vic was horrible about calling and thanking people.
Mm-hmm.
Dolores had to bring him in and sit him in a room.
Yes.
And he called and said, thank you. It's really great, and I appreciate it. And the man said, would you like some more?
Oh, did Vic say, I'm a salesman?
Yeah.
Why, yes. And what size carpet would you like?
I was just like, what? I've never heard of that.
Wow.
Would you like more? I think altogether he gave us $15,000 and $20,000.
Wow.
It was just,
wow.
Saved our lives.
Yeah.
He was great.
Yeah, Bob tells about Vic. They stopped at some timber place in Southern Oregon, and Vic went in, and they wouldn't give him a check because, you know, they were holding out.
Mm-hmm.
And but then Bob remembers at some point before the primary had happened, all of a sudden, those kinds of things.
Yes.
They said, "Oh, McCall's not going to win,"
well,
or at least we're going to
hedging their bets.
Hedging the bets.
That's what they were
but
doing.
It kind of loosened up.
Yeah,
and you know. He said Bob came in, or Vic came out of that first meeting, and he wasn't angry, but he was just so disappointed.
Yeah.
Well,
we got... He wasn't great at asking for money. He didn't do it as well as he could. And we discussed it. Roy Livermore called me. You know, he was the trainer.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, we got to do something. Vic doesn't ask... You know, take him into a room with two or three people who are rich and... He doesn't ask well.
Yeah.
He just says, well, I could use your help.
Yeah.
He said, we're going to have to sort of surround him. So I would go, and he would go to these little lunch meetings and breakfast meetings.
Mm-hmm.
And Vic would go, oh, you know, this is great, and I can use your support, and I really appreciate it.
Mm-hmm.
And then Vic would leave the room, and I'd say, okay, we appreciate your checks today. And I had to make the pitch because he couldn't do it.
Yeah. To the end of his life.
Yeah.
It just, you know, we have not been able to get as much money as we should for the Atiyah collection.
Really?
Because Vic, we're doing okay, but Vic goes and he will say, I could use your support, and he plays poker with him.
Yeah.
And it's like, no, you've got to say to X guy in Southern California, you know, $100,000 would be a big help.
Yes.
You've got to say that.
Yes.
And he won't.
I know.
So,
I can't tell you how many breakfasts and lunches I had with small groups of men saying, okay, they laughed at me because I was this tough bitch coming in there and asking them for their money. Well, it wasn't just asking, it was just, okay, now it's time to pay for your lunch.
Exactly.
And it worked.
Yeah.
But Vic was just terrible.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it was, he got better.
Uh-huh.
But, and we raised a lot of money in the general election. So, was it Vic who, or somebody else? Oh, no, that was Kaor. When the state chairman said, no one's ever raised that much money for a campaign. You can't do that.
Mm-hmm.
And the young man I had brought in as the finance person, I was the consultant for them, said, we're going to raise $500,000.
Mm-hmm.
And even Kay said, I can't raise $500,000. We did.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of these, it might have been the 78 one, but at one point Vic broke the record.
Yeah.
And when you look at the record in today's dollars, it's like $2 million.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, $2 million basically is entry for a state level race.
I know.
And so it's just amazing.
Well, what's his name? Oh, God, I'm terrible on names today. Denny, Congressman
Denny Smith. Yeah.
He broke the record for congressional when he first ran.
Mm-hmm.
And it was hilarious because I told people, I said, watch out. Because if you hold out your hand to shake his hand, his hand is like this. It was just amazing.
Yeah. Another thing I discovered, because I go to the Oregonian Historical Site archive.
Yeah.
But I print out the whole page because printing out the articles doesn't work. So I got the whole pages. That's fine. So on one of the pages with one of the articles, it has the Forbes richest people in the world. It's like J. Paul Getty is number one or something. It's about $4 billion, which in today's dollars would be $9 billion. It makes him 157 on today's list. It's just there's a shift.
I know.
Just amazing.
Yeah, it is.
Just amazing.
Ugh. So.
So anything else stand out about this? I mean, did Vic become a better candidate over time?
Oh, yeah.
Did he grow in? I mean, he'd already had a run-through 4 years earlier, but.
Yeah. It was funny, though. He never had a big ego, except after the election in 78, I think his head got... Well, you know, we always, with the Governors Association, we joke about the imperial governor syndrome that they would get after a while. Well, that kind of got it. And it was after I went to work for the RNC.
Mm-hmm.
And we were putting on this training thing in Seattle, and Vic came and spoke to the group, and he talked about how he won his election in 78, and he said, I had 20,000 volunteers or something. He said, those people loved me. Felt like saying, excuse me, they loved Sharon Page.
Yeah.
But I mean, he said stuff that just, I thought, boy, I wasn't there. I mean, it was just, he, you know, you can't win with just people, political people.
Yeah.
You have to be Vic. Shame on you.
Yeah.
He got bad.
There's everybody does it. I do it. But with Vic, because he did an oral history in the early 90s with the Oregon Historical Society, there are a whole bunch of stories that he told to me word for word, word for word. The same, and then I'm reading the Oregonian coverage from the mid 80s, and it's word for word. So there's things we just get in our heads, and they become our
they
story.
They become the reality.
Yeah. That's so the Green Bay Packers story of going down to see the game, everybody involved thinks that it was another game in another place. And so it's like, okay, so there's these realities of impressions, but no, actually it was here, there, these people. Like that, and that's the fun of writing a book like this.
No, I know. Well, but everyone has their own reality.
Yeah,
you know that.
Yeah.
That's and it's all based on things in their past and their learning and their whole. You know, it's all.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's but it's you go to the same places. People see different things.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's
absolutely.
Why they don't use eyewitnesses testimony at as high a level as they used to.
It's I went to Northwestern for my doctorate because. Political science is so heavy into stats and mathematical modeling, and I don't use it. I hate it.
Oh,
but the stats has stood me in good stead as being a political analyst.
Yeah.
I mean,
well,
great. So you want to know polls? I can do polls from now until the cows come home.
The irony was I had never had statistics until, well, the graduate degree I got at George Mason. But... I learned to read poll results, and I could see what they meant and that sort of thing from the beginning in politics, and I knew about statistics. I knew all of that.
Yeah, yeah.
And it kills me that I didn't take it at Stanford because people kept saying, oh, no, you don't need that. It's hard, and it's not fun for people like you who are, you know, more liberal arts. You just don't need to take
it. Take it because it's not the hard math.
Yeah.
It's the one that you'll actually use in your job.
I know.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what when I got that master's degree, I wanted to take things that I didn't know.
Yeah.
And I took statistics, of course, and I took a course in GIS and spatial analysis.
Oh, great.
Oh, that was wonderful. I had the best time in that course.
Yeah.
I only got a B+. It was one of the lowest grades I got, but I loved it.
Yeah.
Plotting... disease vectors and things.
Yeah.
Oh, I loved that. And Naro Koizumi and I did she was the professor that I took it from. We did a study on immigration and criminality. And there was a study done by a professor in New York showing that new immigrants were generally less criminal, and nobody believed it.
Mm-hmm.
So we did it in Virginia. We studied it, and I got hold of stuff I don't know how I got hold of.
Mm-hmm.
And we did it there, and it's the same thing.
Yeah.
New immigrants are much better behaved.
They're working hard.
Yeah, and later on they generally adapt.
Yeah, yeah. By the third generation, there are no differences.
It's really it's kind of it was interesting. But we did that study.
Yeah.
Using the what do you call it? I still have that ARC. I still send, I don't know why, but the company still sends me their ArcSoft, the regular publication all the time. All the new studies. I love it. I think it works.
That's great.
Yeah, it really
One of the fun things about Vic, his family, is, you know, immigrants are Democrats.
Yeah.
And yet his father was a staunch Republican.
Yeah.
He was so staunch. You know, the little boys growing up, some of their first memories of politics are dad would always have a Republican gathering on election night.
Oh.
And except for 1928, the party would go for 3 or 4 hours and then it would get very quiet and everybody would just go home.
Yeah.
And but so I'm trying to peg down, what is it, because he was a merchant? Were the Syrians from that part, did they turn into Republicans? And that village has been studied. So I'm actually going to be able to go to towns in Pennsylvania and look and see if they were or not. So there's, and Argentina of all places. So there's some
Argentina?
Just, this village, people went to the United States, mainly Pennsylvania, and there are 20 people from that village that came to Portland.
Huh.
And the kids didn't know any of them. The parents occasionally would go to the Syrian neighborhood, but the kids never, ever went.
Well, you know, when Vic was running, we had a wonderful event put on by the Syrian Lebanese community, a food thing that they paid for all the food, and it was fabulous. He was really popular with them.
Yeah, but he was not a part of the community, in effect.
Yeah.
So it's just a fascinating thing.
But they all tended to be Republican. I mean, there's tons of them.
Yeah. And so I just have to peg that down.
Yeah, it's interesting.
And by the second generation, I mean, the kids grew up, there's no immigrant stuff going on there, except they're really interested in the Middle East.
It's fascinating. I know I get on these things that I think, I've got to find out more about that.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll start studying. Why am I doing this? But I do. I worked on a project, when I was at George Mason, I did a... an independent study with Sue Tolchin.
Mm-hmm.
Susan Tolchin and her husband wrote a lot of foreign policy stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I had worked on it with it. It was really fascinating. A World in Flames was the book. It was all about civil unrest and wars and various reasons for it around the world, and that was really interesting working on it. I'd edited it for her. And after that, I signed up for a course. I had trouble finding courses to take because so many of them were things I taught.
Yeah, well.
But I signed up for a course with Richard Florida, who turns out to be an absolute ass.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry. You ever meet him?
No, I didn't.
What a jerk. You ever read his books? He is an ass. He really is. I mean,
biggest ass I ever met was Nelson Polsby.
Oh.
He is just a jerk and a half.
Well, there are plenty of them around. But anyway, Richard Florida, I signed up for this class of his that was a required class.
Mm-hmm.
And it was something weird. Technology and society, or I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
The homework was, the assignments were like high school.
Mm-hmm.
And I had done a lot of actual work on change management.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like this course was supposed to be on change management, and I knew more than he was teaching it.
Mm-hmm.
So I asked somebody, I said, what am I going to do? I asked one of the advisors, what am I going to do? This is stuff I don't even need.
Mm-hmm.
Is it go in? At the break for class, talk to him and say, you know, you really would appreciate it if he could give you some more advanced stuff to do because you're interested and you've done a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had to do it soon because I couldn't drop a class without penalty in another day or two. And I talked to him, and he said, oh, good grief. He said, just drop the class. You know more about it than I do. For God's sake. He said, you don't want to be in here. Mm-hmm. And he said, I it's silly for you to be sitting in my class.
Mm-hmm.
What a wonderful man. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I found out more. He was terrible. He should never have been a professor.
Mm-hmm.
He would leave the country during the course of a course, and his assistant told me once, his teaching assistant said, he didn't know what to do. I didn't know where he was. He never came. It's just awful. Anyway, so I didn't know what I was going to do. So we came out of the classroom. Just as Sue Tolchin went by, I said, what am I going to do? She said, do another independent study.
Mm-hmm.
She said, do one on... One thing, when I worked on that book with her, I did a chart on... what do you call it? The commissions on... my mind is just... I've been thinking about too many different things. Reconciliation.
In Rwanda kind of things? Or yeah. South Africa, truth and reconciliation?
Well, there have been a lot of truth and reconciliation commissions. At that time, I found 26. No one had a list of them.
Yeah.
And so I put together a list of all the ones that had taken place.
That's good. I think one of my senior theses used it about 2 years ago.
Oh, really?
Yes. So thank you for the list.
Oh, you're welcome. Glad it helped. But it was, why it was done and how it worked and all that.
Mm-hmm.
And I had done that. She said, do it. Something on the Truth and Reconciliation Commissions, compare a couple of countries. So I compared South Africa and Sierra Leone, I think. But South Africa was interesting because it was the only one that they monitored regularly with survey research.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing that I found fascinating, I went to talk to the woman who was the chief professor in the Department of Peace Operations or whatever it was called. And she said, oh, there isn't any survey data. That's the problem. You're going to have trouble finding any.
Mm-hmm.
I found this wonderful series.
Mm-hmm.
It's a regular publication.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the South African one, discouraging, but it was much more successful than any of the others.
Yeah.
And it was mainly because of the concept of Uhuru, that reconciliation is what it is.
Yeah.
It's the whole Swahili idea of what you do.
Yeah.
No wonder it worked there
and
not anywhere else.
Yeah.
But anyway, so I did that and gladly got rid of it. But what I should have done is, she said, why don't you cut it down and submit it for a journal article?
Uh-huh.
But I didn't want to. Mm-hmm. I didn't want to cut it down.
Mm-hmm.
It was 60, 70 pages, and I loved writing it and working on it.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I wasn't in the mood.
Yeah.
I used to think, I mean, I've written books, not whole books of nonfiction. I've done just chapters and sections, but I've published fiction for a while.
Mm-hmm.
I do.
That's good.
I've done a lot of things because I like a lot of things.
Yeah.
So.
That's great.
I really like research.
Yeah.
And I just can't help myself.
Yeah.
That's why
this is my first sabbatical ever. And it's like.
Yeah.
Ew, you know, I really like research.
Oh, it's just so much fun.
Except I don't know how to stop.
Well, that's the problem. That is exact. I'll be looking at on one track, and there's something appears on. I never thought of that. I wonder about that.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, no, I can't afford a day and a half of my life over there. I really have to do this.
It's like I was reading. Oh, I don't know. A few years back, I was reading a series of mysteries. Charles Todd. It's actually a woman and her son.
Mm-hmm.
They're good. They're well done. They're old historical.
Mm-hmm.
And in this mystery, the detective was one of the first people in the area of England to have a car.
Mm-hmm.
And he was driving and got caught in a snowstorm and all this stuff. And he'd have to wipe the windshield. I thought, I wonder when they had windshield wipers.
Mm-hmm.
So, of course, I studied the history of windshield wipers.
Mm-hmm.
And it was fascinating. A woman invented the first windshield wipers, but no one would buy them from her. We don't need that.
Yeah.
And no one would buy it. And then the Ford Motor Company stole it from her.
Yeah.
I mean, just nasty stuff. But I had the whole history of windshield wipers.
Yeah.
So I was at a meeting in Virginia. It was some kind of writer's thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I ran into the son of this couple that wrote this book, mm-hmm. and I said, I don't know about the history of windshield wipers.
That's great. It's fascinating because just like maybe 15 years ago, they finally resolved the stealing of the intermittent wipers.
I know.
Same thing.
I know.
Yeah. What's about windshield wipers?
Imagine if you didn't have the first ones that they had, people had to
do. Yeah. No, I've seen, because 50 years ago in like in Germany and some of the Volkswagen Beetles and the Citroëns,
yeah,
you
they
had
have
that.
Little.
Yeah.
It's just amazing. But it was fascinating to study that.
Yeah.
See, I just like doing things like that.
Yeah.
But anyway, so if I didn't have a computer, I don't know what I would do.
Yeah.
So I've got to get a new one.
That happens.
I hate it.
But you
got to
do it.
I know.
You
and
do
I,
it.
It's time.
I used to not get a new computer until all my software didn't work or crucial stuff. So I got my first computer in 89 and I got my third computer in like 2006. And after that I said, you know, I'm finally making enough money. I can get a new computer every 3 or 4
and
years.
And they're cheaper, too.
Yeah. I mean, it cost me $6,000 for the computer and $6,000 for the printer in 89.
Oh, I know.
And now, you know, I got the top-of-the-line Mac and all this stuff, and it cost $2,200.
Yeah. My first computer was wonderful because I found this man who was at the Justice Department, who, as a hobby, was building computers.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It was a new thing. It was in the 80s.
Yeah.
And he said he would build it for me, and it was a pretty reasonable price, $2,000. He would build this thing for me. And but the printer cost more than I paid for it.
Yeah.
And it was it was the advanced dot matrix.
Okay, yeah.
And but that computer was so much fun.
Yeah.
I mean, he told me, just play with it. You can't destroy it. Just play with it. Do what you'll find all sorts of things on it.
I used to teach a class for sophomores on research methods, but we spent 2 weeks how to really use your computer.
Yeah.
It's not just a typewriter and a gaming thing.
See, that's
it does all sorts of stuff.
Yeah.
But the lesson number one is you can't break it.
Yeah.
You know, it's not better than you. If it gives you too much trouble, unplug it.
Yeah.
It's okay. It's just amazing.
My very first computer had a green screen.
Mm-hmm.
And it got, after a while, it got kind of iffy. It would do funny things and it didn't start up well. I would hit it.
Exactly.
And a woman at the computer help thing once actually told me, she said, have you hit it?
Yeah. Those cathode rays to go around. I did, when I was a research assistant in graduate school, I did transcripts of divorce proceedings at Northwestern for the state of Illinois on one of those screens that big with green.
Yeah. Oh, those were just
God, that is just awful.
Oh, yeah.
Just awful.
Yeah. When I was head of field operations at the RNC way many, 1981, one of my regional political directors was a computer nut.
Mm-hmm.
This was new.
Yeah.
And this 1981, he suggested, I had 12 or so top field people, the regionals, and he said, why don't you see if you can get them all portable computers? It'd be wonderful. Well, I got the portable computers. This one woman from Iowa called me and said, why are you getting us portable computers with no porters? Because they were huge.
Gigantic.
They were just enormous.
Gigantic.
But they did good things.
Yeah.
Boy, I'll tell you, that campaign for governor of New Jersey that we won with Kane, that stuff really helped.
Mm-hmm.
Plus the fact I put all my field people up there.
Yeah.
But, Bo, are you getting tired of this whole thing? You're being good.
I tell you, you're doing great.
Yeah, he's been a good boy.
Yeah, you're doing great. So any other big things? He appointed you to work in the administration.
Yeah, I...
And then...
What happened there was kind of interesting. I didn't know what I was going to do.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people were disturbed that he wasn't going to make me the chief of staff.
Mm-hmm. Did you want to be the chief of staff?
No.
Okay.
because I didn't have the kind of experience for that.
Yeah.
And I really didn't. But who was it? One of his key
supporters.
One of his supporters, the key supporters, and I don't remember who, his name, was convinced that I should have been press secretary instead of Denny. And I said, well, if I could, I'd love to, but Denny's got, I mean, he promised, Vic promised him if he did worked on the campaign, he had it. But this man went ahead and really had a quite a project trying to get me as that. And I said, you know, I can't do anything about that because I just, you know, it's not not a possibility. And then these women came to see me. And this group of women from state government, and they said, we want you to go after the job as affirmative action director for the state. And I said, me? They said, yes, we need somebody in there. This is, they told us about all the things that were going on. My gosh. All these, I mean, over in the highway department, they tell people, we don't hire cripples here. And things like, oh, it was awful. And the women just being treated like dirt. And so I went after it, and I had to have Senate approval and confirmation and all that thing. But no, I've always liked to go after, you know, be the underdog and go after the upper dog. That's why I did Kay Orr's campaign too. It's just, you know, it's it's a challenge. And I enjoyed it. I was glad I did it. But I didn't stay that long because it was easy to fix by just changing. It was. They had the affirmative action directors reporting to the director in each agency.
Oh, there you go.
Well, no wonder. God.
Sounds like the military.
We adjusted that a bit and said the affirmative action director reports to the Office of Affirmative Action in the governor's office. And that fixed it. So when the RNC called me and asked me to come to work as a regional political director, I said, oh, that sounds fun. Politics is fun, so I'll do that.
Did you see Vic's interaction with the presidents? With Reagan?
Well,
I mean, you were you were in government when Carter was president, you know, that kind of thing. But did you see?
With Reagan, I wasn't there when Carter was.
You were in Salem.
No, but I'm...
But you're back in D.C. with Reagan.
Yes, and that was funny because, something that happened during the campaign. Got a call during the campaign, and it was not at the very end. It was earlier, and it was from... what's his name? My mind is going today. The Reagan tongue guy. Oh, God, he was a...
Mike Deaver?
No, no, Nofziger.
Lynn Nofziger,
called me and said, we want to send a contribution to your candidate. And the problem was, Vic was still seen as very conservative, and the Ford campaign had, the Ford people hadn't sent anything. It wasn't the campaign then, but it was the Ford group. And I said, I'll have to check on it, and he said, you're telling me you don't want it? I said, I'm not telling you that. I just have to tell Vic. And, and then I immediately called around and said, you know, we got a problem because, and Vic just said, oh, it's not a problem because we'll call so-and-so at the Ford group and get them to send something, and then the Reagan people can send something. But Lynn Nofziger never got over that. And they sent it, but he made a comment to me when I was back in Washington. He said, you know, oh, your friend, the governor, who didn't support Reagan. And, he was nasty about it. And Vic had a run-in with him once back there. Just a very mild one. But it's that comment, you know, you're not exactly a loyalist.
It's fascinating because talking to Pat Amadeo, they found the Reagan administration really tone-deaf dealing with natural resources out here. In the whole West. But also, Vic, once 79, you know, 80, 81, heading into 82, there's some increasingly harsh letters to David Stockman about what the heck are you guys doing to the states? So it's just a fascinating dynamic.
Dave Stockman wasn't one of my favorites.
Yeah.
But, I don't know. Vic did, I mean, he was a surprise for everybody when he was elected. In fact, one of the most fun things during that campaign was when the RNC and the Governors Association sent in the regional political director and somebody else from the RNC to try to, right after the primary, we weren't supposed to win the primary.
Yeah.
They had given money to Tom McCall, and which was generous of them, and they came to see me. Yeah, it's nice of you fellows to come. Vic said, if you want, you can kick them out of your office. You don't have to talk to them. And they came in and they started telling me what I needed to do in the rest of the campaign. I said, we already have a plan. They said, no, you don't, you know, you're not aware of the latest and all so on. And what you should do are these things. And, and you can't do the phone banks the way you've been doing them. You've got to professionalize them. And I said, it's working fine. And they got so annoyed. And I said, I'm sorry, we just, you know, we're running our own campaign here. And I wouldn't let them come back. Vic wouldn't let them come back unless they brought money. And they did.
Yeah.
Ooh, they really, that, and nobody believed Vic was going to win that primary.
Yeah.
People in Washington were stunned at that. And then when he beat the incumbent governor in the general, they really woke up. He definitely was more than they had expected.
Yeah. Well, in 82 as well, you know, all political science says there's just no way he's going to win. And yet, not only does he wins by a record number. Just amazing.
Yeah, he's good.
Just amazing.
He was. I can't keep saying he is. He was good. Hated to see him go. When I saw him, the last time I saw him was at a memorial get-together for Pat Jardina Carpenter out at this winery out last week. And it was such fun going because I had just moved out here and I was seeing everybody I hadn't seen in years. And Vic showed up and he came in the door and said, Carol, look, you're old now. Thanks a lot, Vic. Because he always felt like I was so young when I ran his campaign. And he said, now you're old too. And I thought, jeez, that's not nice, but it was, you know, that was just him. He was so funny.
That's wonderful.
Oh, ouch. It's sitting too long. Hello? Yeah, hi. What? Yes. Are you going to go ahead and go to a friend whose dog is one of Beau's best friends?
Oh, good.
Going up to the dog.
Good.
Park, so. I said, I'll try to join her there.
Yeah.
I think we've talked a long
time. Yeah, yeah.
I didn't realize
No, it's, usually this go an hour and a half. We're an hour and 42 right now. So.
Well, I talk a lot. That's one of my things.
That's good. That's good.
When I did it, when I went to my 50th reunion at Stanford, they had this new thing where they would invite people to come and be interviewed and to for the part of the record. And then they gave us, sent us copies of what they put together for But I can't tell you how long. It was like 2 hours we talked about Stanford stuff that we did and stuff that I hadn't ever told anyone we did. And because I was vice president of the senior class, so they wanted me to talk about it. And I did talk.
That's good.
I definitely talked. So. Sometimes.
I taught at, you know, a little bit at Northwestern, but mainly I taught at University of Portland and then Pacific. And there's no culture of practical jokes. You know, at Stanford, you cannot believe the thing is, so I'll tell them occasionally. So people went skiing, they came back, their door was gone because we sheetrocked it. And they, you know, they couldn't find their door. That's so, but, you know, you check, here's an easy one. Try this.
I mean, but it's amazing. Nothing. They're so serious.
They're so serious.
We had one of my neighbors at my the freshman dorm was Estelle Noland, who was the daughter of Senator Noland. She thought she was pretty important, and she went somewhere for a weekend, and we took all our furniture and hid it. And we did. Oh, but the very best the whole time I was there was the Kappa Sigs. I don't remember which that is. My ex-husband was in the fraternity.
Mm-hmm.
They bought this old fishing boat.
Mm-hmm.
And they, Ted and somebody else went out and got from a Navy facility, borrowed a big pump
mm-hmm.
thing, put it on the back of this boat, took it out on Lake Lagunita, and mm-hmm. everybody knew that this was the Aqua Wazoo.
Mm-hmm.
It was out there on Lake Lagunita, and they were going to have a big takeover.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people were sitting at the boathouse, and they played the boat came roaring out onto Lake Lagunita. You can imagine that huge
boat. Oh, yeah.
And they had a pirate flag, and they were playing the music from Victory at Sea.
That's great.
On all the loudspeakers in the boathouse of Victory at Sea.
Exactly.
But the unfortunate, the Sigma Chi's had been worn.
Uh-huh.
And Robin Moore, was that his name, the swimmer, was a Sigma Chi. And he uh-huh. and some others got this big log, made it into a battering ram with a metal front. And they came out from under the dock. And went after the Battle of the Aqua Wazoo. It was absolutely wonderful.
That's great.
It was just, I mean, that kind of thing is just, you know.
Yeah, yeah. And yeah, it's just, that's not the culture.
No.
At the places
I mean,
I've
what
been.
I,
it's just amazing.
I don't know how we got away with some of it. When we were forced, instead of, you know, it used to be that the girls could draw for housing and stay if they wanted their whole time.
Right.
They changed it. The end of our sophomore year, and said you have to draw every year now.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that was awful because we were in Stillman and we were happy.
Oh yeah.
We got stuck in Florence Moore, and it was
uh-huh.
brand new.
Yeah.
And that was not what we had in mind. And there was a fire road that came down from
mm-hmm.
above, and
I lived
they
in Flomo for 3 years, so I
oh yeah, you
inside
know
and out.
Yeah. So there were posts in there that
yeah.
they were chained.
Yeah.
That annoyed us because it was such an easy way to get in there,
yeah.
and they wouldn't let us.
Yeah.
So one night, just girls doing this, we took the posts out, and we had bought quick drying cement,
mm-hmm.
and fixed it
mm-hmm.
up and filled the holes.
Mm-hmm. There you go.
They got really mad. But it was just, you know, I mean, college
yeah.
was supposed to be fun.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
We worked hard, but we had fun.
Yeah. One of the freshmen in my dorm, I lived in Paloma my first year.
Yeah.
And he had been conceived in Paloma.
Oh.
Back when it was an all-women's dorm and Dad stuck in the window.
Oh, what? Oh, I was in...
There's a Longa Cardinal Merlot.
Merlot.
Yeah.
Merlot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Loro. Faison
Gavilan.
Yeah.
Yeah. God. Well, I'm glad you understand. People think, oh, Stanford, that must have been very serious. No. Oh, you had to.
Everybody studied like hell, but they did it, you know, however they did it.
Yeah.
And when things had to happen,
well,
we made
yeah.
the battering rams.
I know.
I interviewed a guy from Cal yesterday. I didn't know he's from Cal. I didn't know he was from Stanford. And eventually got around and said, yeah, we go to the basketball games with Vienna sausages and
oh,
throw
yeah.
them on the floor saying, you mean it. He said, yeah, we'd throw oranges at you in the football
yeah.
team. That's why we had our lacrosse team to catch them and throw them back.
The football games, though, we used to take, oh, there were some medical students who would inject oranges with vodka.
Yeah.
And I was going out with one of my freshman year. And, boy, that used to be fun.
Yeah,
exactly. You couldn't have liquor.
No, you can't have liquor, but have an orange.
Oh.
Exactly.
Really,
citrus is good for you.
We were so healthy.
Yeah.
It was really, yeah, but we had such a good time.
Yeah.
Did a lot of... The one of the favorites, though, that we did, we had in Florence Moore, we were paired with Chi Psi for Spring Sing,
mm-hmm.
and they didn't do anything. They just wouldn't practice or wouldn't do anything.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had this habit of writing new words for popular songs
mm-hmm.
that we'd do
mm-hmm.
it for fun.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote one, and I don't remember what the song was. I have it somewhere. But it's a song about the Chi Psi's, and we all wore black and with big Chi Psi pins, this
mm-hmm.
thing, and sang this because the Chi Psi didn't come. It was great.
That's wonderful.
Anyway, those were the days. Stanford was a fun place to be.
Yeah.
And I worked while I was in school too, yeah. because it's the only way I could make it. But still, there was time for fun.
Yeah, yeah, it's amazing. I washed dishes my first year.
Oh.
And going back, even for my 10-year reunion. Mm-hmm.